name's Noah Morris.
My name is Varun Gokarn, and I'm interviewing Noah Morris, and today is June 1st, 2006. So, just going to start out with, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
Well, I was originally born and raised in and around Providence, Rhode Island, and I now live in a van down by the river in New Orleans.
So, did you... you went to high school in Providence,
college? I went to high school outside of Providence for a year and a half at Bristol County Agricultural Vocational High School. I then spent a semester in college at a local community college, and then I went on to college where I got a BA at Simon's Rock.
Okay. And how do you think... those experiences or your like family experiences during those years like shaped what you're doing in New Orleans right now?
Well, I got in a lot of trouble in school and high school for speaking my mind and doing what I felt like doing, and I still just we just came down here because we wanted to come down here, and we opened our clinic because we wanted to open a place that would give free access to healthcare to people, the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and we continue doing that to this day.
What sort of things were going through your mind when you made the decision to come down to New Orleans?
That we would very likely be denied entry into the disaster area by U.S. federal authorities or military or police or someone, and that we were of the mindset that we would continue trying to get in by hook or by crook until we successfully got into New Orleans, because we saw the way the immediate aftermath of the hurricane was being handled and some of the political dialogue about what was to be done about the city as appearing to be the preempting for a massive land grab and gentrification of New Orleans and a general whitening of New Orleans, driving out a lot of the local communities of color.
So those like thoughts that are going through your head, how did you get that, those opinions of like what was going on in New Orleans, or what media factors, what biases shaped that?
Well, I mean, I identify with a lot of the political analysis that would land me in the camp with a camp of anarchists, and we typically, or I anyway, typically view that the U.S. government is not a benevolent entity, and when you're seeing footage of a flooded city, people hungry with guns being pointed at them and helicopters buzzing them while they're on a highway that they're can't stay in their city, but they can't leave either because they're being told they're not allowed to walk out. And, you know, you see these news copters flying around, and the fact that you hear stories of people shooting at the helicopters and whatnot, when they're, you gotta think about what someone's thinking. Their home's flooded. They know people they know are dead. They're sitting on their roof where they've been for 2 days. And you're sitting there in a helicopter that could be rescuing people, videotaping them. Quite frankly, I'd understand why they might be shooting at the news copters. I mean, hindsight being 2020, we actually come to find out that they were shooting at the helicopters. Not at them, but shooting up into the air to try to get their attention. saying, bang, bang, here I am, come rescue me. You must miss that I'm down here.
And so this, like, all these things that were happening in New Orleans and a lot of the effects that we're seeing now that have been around for, like, decades, such as, like, racial issues, economic issues, marginalization of certain groups. How did you know much about that before Katrina?
I didn't know a lot of the specifics about New Orleans and the particular dynamics of the racial and class conflicts that have been happening here for hundreds of years. But I had a general familiarity with the racial disparities and the class disparities in this country at large. I've lived in major metropolitan cities with large, you know, populations of urban poor. And, you know, they're urban poor, like, a ghetto's a ghetto anywhere in the world. You've been to one, you've seen what it's like in most of them. And, you know, I didn't have to know the specifics to know that, you know, good, hardworking people were left to, you know, eat flood water for all the U.S. government was concerned of, you know. Oh, they were having people, military and cops, patrol the uptown areas, which are the upper class areas of New Orleans, while at the same time where people were still in the city, at the Superdome and at the convention center and in the flooded parts of the city, these same personnel, instead of guarding private property, could have been out helping rescue people and doing something that actually would have been moral at the time, but instead they were ordered to go and patrol the rich neighborhoods to make sure no one broke into their houses, while other people had already lost everything from the flood and were near to losing their lives and needed rescue. And at the same time, the U.S. government was more interested with guarding rich folks' property.
So, I mean, you talk about these sorts of conditions in a lot of different cities in the United States. Do you have, like, a specific example of something that, like, really angered you other than, like, before Katrina?
Oh, man. There are plenty of things. You know, the fact that when I lived in Brooklyn, you know, people would get, in my neighborhood, would get stopped for walking while black. When I was going to some court hearings in Boston, damn near every other case aside from mine started off with the incident report being like, suspect was driving. Suspect was driving. You know, people were, all these young black men and black women, and middle-aged black men and black women, and old black men and black women were obviously getting pulled over simply because they were black. You know? And, like, you know, most of them had court-appointed lawyers, and most of them, you know, were being told to just cop a plea. And, you know, I was there just going through the motions awaiting scheduling of a jury trial, because goddamn it, if you give me the right, I'm gonna take it. And, you know, you see this type of pattern. If one just simply goes to a courthouse, any criminal courthouse in any big city, you will see a distinct majority of the defendants will be people of color, far outnumbering that, you know, person's individual's ethnicity or group's ethnicities percentage of the city's population or the county population. So it seems there is a consistent targeting across the boards of poor people of color by a systematic campaign of harassment by the police in this country. I mean, just last night, we were sitting out at the lighthouse in Verrett. And, you know, there were like, I don't know, 12, 18 of us sprawled out onto the sidewalk, drinking, being loud. And no cops come. The cops that drive by don't even look at us. However, if that was our neighbors across the street, it would stop. They'd take everyone off the porch. They'd cuff them in 2x2s. They'd run everyone's IDs for warrants and see what's going on. I mean, the only difference between the two groups, we were predominantly white, and our neighbors are predominantly black.
Is there something special about New Orleans and the way, like, race is treated in this city that's different from the ones that you've encountered previously?
New Orleans is the first place I've spent a lot of time in the Deep South. And the thing that strikes me is a more obvious difference from most of the places I've been on the West Coast or in the Northeast is that it's racial issues are right out there on the table. Everyone will talk about it. You know? Oh, a racist will be perfectly happy being a racist pig, like, loudly, publicly, drunkenly in a bar, which you only really see out of people who actively identify as neo-fascists up north or on the West Coast. And, this is also probably one of the most integrated cities I've ever lived in. I've lived in poor black neighborhoods, I've lived in poor Spanish, predominantly Spanish neighborhoods. But we didn't really kick it with too many of our neighbors. We tried, we sat on the stoop, they'd sit on the other side of the stoop, we wouldn't really talk too much. We tried, we smoked blunt sometimes, but, you know, there was just kind of inherent. Like, we'd kick it and get wrecked, but we wouldn't just kick it. We wouldn't end up in the same bars. We wouldn't end up in, you know, we wouldn't end up just, you know, as thrown together and perfectly happy about it. You know, the rush hour subway coming in from Brooklyn to Manhattan, it's a very interesting sight. You see people from every continent, all different racial backgrounds, who do all different types of work, sitting there, not talking to each other, glaring at each other distrustfully, and silently minding their own business. Here, you can't stand next to someone, be they black, white, brown, yellow, rich, or poor, without someone striking up a conversation with you. And all the taboos of what one doesn't speak of to strangers or people one doesn't know well, sex, politics, religion, are commonplace here. It's really amazing. People are so much nicer here. You can walk down the street, say hi to every person, and every person will say, like, hi back, what's up back.
That's true, yeah.
You leave here, you're walking down the street, you're all happy, you know, it's a sunny day, it's pretty out. You say hi to everyone, and, like, most of the people look at you like you got a second head on your shoulder. Some of them just stare right through you. Other people don't even acknowledge your existence. Yeah, it's ridiculous. I think a lot of the historic struggles that have happened in and around New Orleans over the centuries have added a lot. There's a reason this city can claim to be a large part of the soul of this country, because it is. So much of the good and the worst parts of this country reside here.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk maybe about your experience like coming into New Orleans. So can you tell me like your first day in New Orleans, like how you got in, what was going on, who you were with?
So the night of September 8th, myself, Boy Scott, Roger, Bork, and a couple of kids from Connecticut Food Not Bombs roll into Covington, Louisiana, where there's a Red Cross shelter that's jointly being run by the Veterans for Peace and the Red Cross. And we just kind of get there. It's like midnight. We talk to some folks from Vets for Peace about just kind of gathering some intelligence now that we're closer to being on the ground of what's going on in the city. How can we get in? And that day, they had actually made their first, Veterans for Peace had made their first successful trip into Orleans Parish and dropped off some food and supplies at Malik Rahim's house. And we had been in touch with Malik Rahim on and off on our drive down. And so we wake up the following morning, we help just like sort some stuff and do a little work at the camp and get ourselves, repack our vehicles and pack another van with supplies that was gonna escort us down there, and took off. And we got to the causeway, and there was a military checkpoint, and the van in front, our lead van, we had given, you know, our medical credentials to, and some press credentials that some folks had, and said that we were going in to help with the voluntary, we lied, we said we were going in to help with the voluntary evacuation of the West Bank of New Orleans, and you know, they waved us through, and then our lead van got one flat on the causeway, changed the tire, got another flat when we got turned around from taking I-10 into the city. And then we had to walk off the highway, and we found a tire shop, and we swapped out our flat tire for a tire that fit. And thankfully, someone had already broken the window out, so that was easy to do. And from there, we went on without any real hitch to Malik Rahim's house. Showed up, like, hey, nice to meet you. We're your medics. We hear you got a space for us to set up in. Where's that? And we were brought over to the Masjid Bilal, which is a local mosque, and began starting putting tarps down over the carpet of the sanctuary and unpacking the vehicle. And two local women who ran a free school in the neighborhood before the storm came and helped us set up and clean up the mosque and whatnot. And we looted some plywood and spray painted a sign that said, you know, first aid station. Roger got taken around the neighborhood by Rafua and Alanda, the two women who helped us set up, and was introduced to some of the people who had stayed. And then it was 6 o'clock, and it was curfew, and so we sat on the stoop of the porch, or the stoop of the mosque, Then we saw an energy truck rolling by, or a power company truck, and so we flagged it down. And we're like, hey, we're a free clinic. Can you, or we're setting up an aid station here. Can you maybe fix our power? Can you reconnect that wire to the building? So they hooked us up, our power, and to the other couple of houses on the block that people were in. So we had power, you know, within a few hours after we got there, but it took them a while to fix it. So we're sitting there in like damn near pitch darkness, except for the military vehicles rolling by and the energy truck. That was our first day. Saw maybe 5 or 6 patients.
So you had known about Malik Rahim, who's this pretty big like personality in a lot of different movements, but also in New Orleans, and now especially after like Common Ground, really big presence. What did you think, like having like talked to him, and now like the first day where you met him, what did you think of him?
Well, I didn't really have much not much preemptory knowledge of Malik before I got down here. Just I read like the initial interview he did with the Bayview out in San Francisco, and I didn't really know much of his history. I mean, he's an interesting, good-hearted, genuine, stubborn man. Yeah.
What do you mean by stubborn?
He's stubborn. He's a pain in the ass to deal with sometimes, just like most people who like have very strong views and very strongly held opinions on how they should be put forward and whatnot, you know? I'm stubborn. I'm a pain in the ass to deal with much of the time.
So tell me about the first couple months. Like, how did this first aid station sort of evolve into the Common Ground Health Clinic that we know now?
Well, I mean, by the end of the first, the middle of the next day, having seen some of the medical conditions we were seeing, we realized, you know, we were a couple of EMTs, like, we were thinking we were going to be treating, like, you know, trauma. We were treating, you know, lack of accessible health care for the entirety of a person's life, you know? And so we instantly started putting calls out through previously existing networks we knew of radical healthcare workers. And we called Scott Weinstein because we knew he was in the area. And we were like, we need a nurse. We need doctors. We need herbalists. We need anyone who does anything medically inclined that heals people, because this population is hurting so bad right now and has been hurt so bad. And maybe on day 4 or 5, Scott Weinstein arrived. And then, you know, Michael Kozart and B and Dixie and Oliver Marzenka and Natasha and maybe one or two other people. Thomas, I think that may be it, arrived in a caravan from the Bay Area. And with them, those people represent a crisis counselor, an MD, EMT, some wilderness first responders, street medics, acupuncturists, herbalists. And we continue to put the call out and saying, you know, oh, there's no justifiable reason why this should not be the biggest converging place of radical medical workers in the country right now. And not just radical medical workers, we instantly, once, you know, we start our chatter started about the health clinic on the internet and whatnot, you know, people were just finding us, and like the press was finding us, and the name was getting out, and some the basic story was getting out. And we were accessible. We weren't like the Red Cross saying, like, take this 8-hour class and then we might contact you and you'll come down for 2 weeks and we'll pay you $50 a day to be here. And, you know, we just said, yeah, come. Hope you don't mind sleeping on the floor with the rest of us. And it just grew. And, you know, after Hurricane Rita, we were seeing, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. As many as 140 people in a day. And the need has just never gone away. So neither have we. And now we're transitioning into still being, you know, primarily volunteers. But now most of our providers are local. And so we've used the publicity we've gotten and the name we've made for ourselves and the work we've done to help set up a free clinic that will hopefully be eventually entirely staffed by New Orleans residents. Maybe some of us who came from out of state will just put down roots here and stay with it, but then we'll be residents too, and we'll have a beautiful free clinic. Hopefully we'll have dozens of beautiful free clinics all over this city, you know, thousands more all over the country.
So you've decided to stay in New Orleans for a while now.
Indeed I have.
What made you come to that decision? What sealed the deal for you?
Oh man, this city is just amazing. The people are amazing. The music's amazing. The history is amazing. It's a little hot, but I mean, it's just an amazing place.
What's one of your favorite things to do in New Orleans?
Oh man, just go to a bar, kick back, have a drink or two, listen to some amazing, amazing musicians just like night after night after night. I mean, it's like there aren't really that many bad musicians in this town, you know? Even the people just playing on the street corners are amazing.
Talked a little bit about setting up the clinic and why you chose to stay. So what do you think New Orleans is going to look like in, I don't know, in the future? Is it a place that you think you want to start, you would want your family to come down to, that you want to start your own family?
No. 20 years, this place is going to be a swamp. Unless the political will of this country changes and the general patterns of humanity change, this place will be a swamp where Lake Pontchartrain sits with a little bit of swamp between it and the Mississippi River.
So how long are you going to stay down here until it recedes back into marshland?
I really don't know. That's too far in advance. I'll be here a while, though. That's for darn sure.
What do you think about the healthcare system in New Orleans and how that's gonna change, or if it's gonna change?
Well, a lot of people have now, in the medical profession, realized that medicine, as it has been being done, doesn't really work so well anymore. And in a lot of ways, it never worked that well. You know, treating the symptoms when they come up isn't nearly as effective as treating the causes. So when we treat the causes, the class differences, the marginalized position most communities of color are put in this country, the lack of access to affordable health care, so much of this country gets their health, primary health care through the emergency room, that can't work. It's not sustainable. We spend more dollars on health care per patient in theory than any other country, that we have one of the most abysmal healthcare systems of the developed world. And if we actually took that money and used it in an intentional way to make healthy people, it works so much better. I mean, but the whole system has to change from bottom to up. Med school should cost, you know, $5 a month. Doctors and nurses should not be coming out of their educational training thinking they're gonna have to make $1 million in the first, 2 years they're on their own just to pay off all the loans. Medical school should be cheap and it should be accessible for anyone who shows the skill to practice medicine. And until that changes, much of the other factors that are messed up in the healthcare system, the drive to privatize healthcare and make it a for-profit thing, and will be eliminated when every medical worker comes out of their medical education training in debt, and sometimes in staggering amounts of debt. Until we fix those solutions, the quality of care being given to society at large will be bad anywhere you go, be it New Orleans or elsewhere.
So, do you think that the clinic in any way has changed healthcare significantly in New Orleans or in Algiers?
I mean, I think we still don't have the ability to see as many people as could be seen. We're just, you know, a drop in the bucket as far as the volume of patients we see. But we give them a higher quality of healthcare most of the time than they are receiving elsewhere, and that a lot of people get who have insurance, you know? People have the ability to get herbal consultations. People have the ability to, you know, talk with some counselors or, you know, see a doctor or a nurse practitioner, get their blood work done, get some massage work done, all under one roof. I mean, we don't have any fancy x-ray, and we don't have anything of hospital caliber. But we got a lot of love in the healing we're trying to do, and all we are is a model of how things could be better. Changes unto the individual, and when enough of us change, then we'll actually start seeing those real changes happening and the systemic change that needs to happen in this world happen.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure, man.